Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live once again to take your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith and would like to raise those questions here on the program, we can discuss them together. And also, of course, if you have an alternative viewpoint you'd like to raise, we can discuss that as well. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to be on the program, we have a line open for you and would be glad to talk to you in the coming hour. It's always advisable, if you want to get on the program, to call as early in the hour as you can. You might have to wait on hold a little while, but it's better to get your foot in the door rather than wait till the end of the program and not be able to get through. So the number is 1-800-438-5090. And Michael from Live Oak is our first caller today. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Now we need his volume raised, I believe. There we go. Hi, Michael.
Now, can you hear me?
Yes, your voice has suddenly appeared.
All right. Anyway, the other day I didn't really get it. I was fumbling around trying to communicate something, and I realized I wasn't really being very clear, but let me just come at it from a different angle. So in the understanding of the mind that was taught by the Buddha and other Eastern teachers, the basic nature of mind or consciousness is the simple ability to know or experience. And that nature, I mean, that could also be called spirit, that which is the basis for our life embodiment, our being alive is synonymous with being conscious. And that nature is actually completely unaffected by the stream of experience. The awareness of water is not wet. It's that which experiences wetness. Any emotion, anger, joy, that's all being experienced, but that actual mind, nature, consciousness that is just there, it's like a mirror. A mirror reflects things, but it's never actually affected by the images that are placed before it.
Well, I have to say I don't understand the Buddhist philosophy, extremely well. So you can help me out here. Are you saying that our experiences in the world do not change who we are, basically?
It's not really a who, but the nature. Consciousness is...
Okay, so the reality of our personhood remains an unchanged reality, regardless what happens to us?
The personhood is a movement within the mind or consciousness.
So what is your point for us with reference to your call, then?
Right. So, that's why I said a couple of meetings ago, I wish I could actually go back and ask Jesus what exactly he meant, because in some ways it seems to be the same thing. He's talking about becoming, living from the heart. I mean, it seems that what the Christian notion of salvation is you're living more from a non-reactive place. The ordinary being will just follow his or her instincts.
Well, but the behavior that you're describing, you're right. I mean, Christians are supposed to live that way, and I know that other religions, including Buddhism, probably encourages a very similar way of living. But the Christians living that way is really more like the symptom of the Christian disease, if we might put it that way.
That is, if you, the expression.
Yeah, if you catch Christianity its symptoms, the syndrome, will be in living a sincere and godly life and of love and service to other people. But the disease itself, and I'm using the word disease, of course, metaphorically, but the thing itself is not that behavior. The thing itself is a life that's been reoriented from self to God. Christianity teaches that we are born and live our lives, at least until conversion, focused upon one interest primarily, and that is ourselves, looking out for ourselves. Many people even turn to religions in order to gain something for themselves. Even religions that are very philanthropic, religions that are very, self-sacrificing, many times people turn to those religions not because they are themselves selfless, but because they gain some kind of maybe psychic pleasure or psychic satisfaction out of feeling that they are being good or doing the right thing. That's still a form of being self-centered. The self-centered core of human nature is one of the basic tenets of the Christian faith. It's called sin, that we're born concerned about ourselves primarily, enough so that even a little baby doesn't care who's inconvenienced when his diaper's wet or when he's hungry or when he's in bed and he wants to be lifted up. The baby doesn't care how much he inconveniences anybody else in his world, even the people who've been the kindest to him. He just cares about himself. And that's right. That's in human nature. Now, conversion to Christianity is a reorientation of oneself from self-interest to God-interest. That is focused on, well, basically it's an acknowledgement, which I think sanity would require, that the universe is not about me. The universe wasn't made for me. It wasn't made to revolve around me. The universe is made to revolve around its creator, and I'm not it. I'm not the creator. So when I get myself oriented properly to the creator, then I am in sync with reality. And so what has to be recognized is that my self-centeredness is a flaw. It's really a defect in the machine, and that it needs to be fixed. You've got to have something at the core changed, and that is that I will no longer be concerned primarily about myself. I will be concerned primarily about what pleases and glorifies the Creator, because that's what the creation was made for. And as soon as I get myself aligned with that, I'll be aligned with reality instead of living in a fantasy of my own making.
Let me try and tie this together, because it actually, believe it or not, it actually does seem to, maybe it's just different words for the same thing, but the Buddha said that the self is an illusion. You mentioned defect, something at the core needs to be radically changed. From the Buddha's point of view, what one thinks of when one says I or me or mine, that's pointing back to something that seems very real. But if you, according to what he had to say, if you actually look and try and find that, it's not findable. There seems to be a center or a self.
Yeah, I think it's not just different words, but I think it's a different concept in biblical Christianity, because biblical Christianity does not teach that self is an illusion. In fact, self is very important. Having oneself in right alignment with God and with all that He's made is a very important thing, and that the self is an extremely important thing, because according to God, we were made in God's image. And what is made in God's image cannot be insignificant. So, the illusion is not that I have a self. The illusion is, instead of thinking of myself as a creature made in God's image and having great significance, I think of myself as God, the God of my own universe. That's the defect. The defect is not in thinking that self is real, because self really is real. It's a creation of God. It simply isn't created by God to be in the center of anything.
But again, words can be they have multi connotations. It can be hard to pin down certain things or
yeah. Michael, I don't you know, I don't want to be hard on you, but I don't think you're making yourself more clear in this conversation than in the last one. And you know, what I would suggest is, since you do call frequently, and I would like to understand what you're thinking, I'm interested in myself and my listeners understanding what you're getting at, I would recommend that you actually, in preparation for calling the show, maybe write out your thoughts. Write them out in a way that you feel can succinctly get across the point you want. Because on a show like this where there's calls waiting, I can't just meander.
Give me just a few more seconds, because I know exactly what I'm trying to say. I'm just trying to phrase it in a way that would be useful or clear. It said somewhere in the Bible, there's a statement that God is love, right? It does say that somewhere.
Yes, it does. Yep.
So, by self, it's not saying that there's no being. It's not saying that a person doesn't exist, but a person, the sense of existence, what you were saying before. The attitude of me versus everything else and my needs above all others, that is the basis for that, which is an instinctual grasping at one's own immediate self-interest versus like the fruits of the spirit type of qualities that will emerge.
I guess the difference with Christianity as opposed to Buddhism, I believe, is one of motivation. Again, I think that Buddhism probably encourages us to live an others-oriented life. That is, you know, put other people on the same level you put yourself, you know, live humbly, you know, serve humanity. I'm sure that all those things would be values that Buddhism would recommend, as well as Christianity. The difference being, though, that Buddhism does not necessarily even believe that there is a God, and Christianity is entirely focused, not only on the existence of God, but on the centrality of God to all meaning. And therefore, when we look at the similarities, let us say, in the external teachings of, you know, ethical or spiritual behavior, as taught by Jesus on one hand and the Buddha on the other hand, We're looking at a very surface consideration, because even in a Muslim, a Hindu, a Buddhist, a Christian, a Jew, an atheist, they can all live an others-centered life in some respects. They can all see the value in not being totally selfish. But the motivation is what differs. And you see, what the Bible teaches is that humanity was made to be connected to God, in a right relationship with God, to draw upon God, to draw our life, to draw our meaning from God. And we do that by putting our total confidence in Him, by making His glory and His interests the central concern of our lives. And this is not just in the abstract of being good people. It's in the sense of having a real relationship with a real God who's really there and who we expect to glorify and enjoy His company forever. So obviously, Buddhism has a different core than that. Now, insofar that there are similarities between Buddhism, that is, the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of Christ, I have to say I find the teachings of Christ a lot easier for me to grasp. Now, that might be just because I haven't been oriented in an Eastern mindset as much as maybe you have, but like when you share things that you say are the same thing that Jesus taught and that Buddha taught, And you put them in a Buddhist sort of parlance.
Right.
To tell you the truth, I have to. It could be my own fault, but I get confused. I can't really make sense of it. Whereas when Jesus said, listen, if someone strikes you on one cheek, turn the other cheek. You know, if somebody wants to sue you and take your coat, give them your cloak also. love your neighbor as you love yourself. Do good to those who persecute you, and pray for those who despitefully use you. And these sentences are not esoteric at all. They're very practical. They're very straightforward. And if indeed what Jesus is teaching is, as you seem to be suggesting, very similar, or if not identical, to what the Buddha was teaching about these behaviors, then why not follow it from Jesus, since he was clear and Buddha was kind of abstract?
Well, the point is that as the self-grasping begins to diminish, then that which is holy, that which is sacred, becomes revealed.
Even this last statement of yours is an example of what I'm talking about. I'm sure that statement means something to you, and it probably means something to anyone out there listening who has studied, you know, Eastern religion and so forth. But I think that when Jesus makes his statements, they're understandable to people of any culture. I mean, like I said, if someone strikes you on one cheek, turn the other cheek. Those exact words translated into any language convey a clear idea, a clear thought. Whereas the words you're using make sense probably within some kind of an Eastern mindset, but they didn't make sense to me. And I'm not saying they weren't lucid or whatever in the context you're using them. I'm saying that if we want to say, listen, Buddha taught us a good way to live and Jesus taught us a good way to live, even if we didn't bring God into the picture, I'd still rather read it from Jesus than from the Buddha, because I can understand what Jesus said.
Yeah, there are passages, there are statements that the Buddha made that are almost verbatim identical.
I'm sure there are. In fact, almost every religious leader said something very similar to the Golden Rule. Michael, the point I'm making is this, that there is a core difference between Christianity and Buddhism. I, of course, believe Christianity is true, and insofar as Buddhism is different than Christianity, I think that Buddhism is mistaken or wrong. You may see things the other way around, but the point is, it's a mistake to say they're essentially the same. They're not essentially the same, because Buddhism does not believe in a personal God who loves his creation, who against whom the creation has rebelled and become alienated, and who sent his son to die and redeem and recover a relationship permanently with that creation. That's what Christianity teaches, and Buddhism doesn't teach any of those things. So regardless how much Buddhism and Jesus may both teach us to love our neighbor, the reasoning for it, the motivation for it, and the whole philosophy behind it is like at poles apart. And so
I just wonder, when Jesus was using these terms, and again, we weren't back there.
Well, Michael, like I said, I can't keep going forever when there's calls waiting. But I let me just say this to you. At the beginning of our call today, you mentioned that you kind of wish you could go back and talk to Jesus and ask him what he meant about these things. And while we can't go and look at him face to face and sit down, you know, by the Sea of Galilee and have that kind of a conversation with him today, we can nonetheless reach some degree of confidence that we can understand what he's teaching by putting ourselves more or less into his cultural skin. Jesus was Jewish. He was not an Eastern guru. He was more like a Jewish prophet. Of course, he was the Messiah, but he, you know, the paradigm of Jesus' ministry was like that of a Jewish prophet. It was not like that of an Eastern guru. And the Jewish prophets had a certain message that Jesus also preached. Jesus indicated that he was the last chance God was giving the Jews to get it right, and all the previous prophets were their earlier chances. And so he was coming with a similar message to that of the prophets. Now, if we want to understand what Jesus said, we could just read Matthew, or we could just read John. But if we have ourselves an Eastern religion mindset, we'll be reading words that Jesus used that we already have different associations for those words than he might have. But that doesn't put us hopelessly in a position of being unable to know what he said, because you yourself are Jewish. You yourself had a Jewish upbringing. You abandoned that when you became a Buddhist. But when you went to Hebrew school, I assume you studied the law and the prophets somewhat, the Torah. And I'd recommend, if you really do wish you could go back and talk to Jesus and find out what he meant, that you do the next best thing, and that is immerse yourself in the Torah. Immerse yourself in what Christians call the Old Testament, what your own Jewish people call the Tanakh. because that was what Jesus was immersed in, and the culture to whom he spoke was immersed in it. So that when he used words and phrases, he used words and phrases that would have been understood by his hearers in the context of what Moses and the prophets had said, and not in some entirely different. I think a lot of times people just ignore the Jewish cultural background of Jesus and his listeners, and they'll take what he said and try to apply them, you know, from some kind of esoteric Eastern mindset. And while that may be a very clever exercise, it's not likely to give us a true understanding of what Jesus was about. What Jesus was about will be found in seeing the place that he holds in the long line of the prophets through whom God revealed himself to Israel. And once you have read and meditated on and digested the law and the prophets, when you come then to the New Testament, read about Jesus, he fits very naturally into a particular stream of revelation. And what he says, by the way, most of the time he was just saying the same things that the law and the prophets and the Psalms said. Hardly anything Jesus taught is absent from the Old Testament. Almost everything Jesus taught can be found in the law or the prophets or the Psalms, especially the Psalms. And so as you become acquainted with your own Jewish heritage and the writings of your own Jewish prophets, then when you read Jesus, you will be much better than you are now in a position to know what Jesus meant when he spoke, because his disciples and his audience were expected to understand, with the exception of the parables that he told to the crowds, and they were directly concealing certain things about his message. But his moral teaching and his teaching about himself were certainly to be understood within the Jewish framework of his society and his culture. Michael, we've spent all, half the program talking to each other while others are waiting, so I'm going to have to move along, but I appreciate your call, and we'll talk again. All right. Let's talk to Peter from Dyer, Indiana. And if you'd like to be on the program, the number to call is 1-800-438-5090. Peter, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask you today about a passage in Micah. It'll be Micah 5, verse 3. And the reason I'm asking about it is I had a discussion with my pastor, who's a dispensationalist, and he sees this as a proof text against amillennialism for dispensationalism.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so I'm not very familiar with Micah myself, but in trying to look at it and understand how it might be understood from a millennial perspective, I had some difficulty understanding verse 3. There's a clause there which mentions, therefore he will give them up until the time. Well, I'm not exactly sure what might be given up. Of course, I'm sure you know the dispensationalist view is that has something to do with the Jewish remnant being given up from the time of Christ.
From the time of Christ
until
the last days, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, but what would that be in an amillennialist perspective?
Well, when Micah said that God is going to give them up, I believe he's talking about his sending them away into captivity. And the remnant returning to him are those who did return to him when Jesus came. In other words, the disciples who followed Jesus were the remnant of Israel. And they became, of course, the core of the church. So, as I understand it, see, this is talking about how Israel and Judah were going to be going into captivity. And, you know, they would, especially the nation of Israel to the north, there's references both to Israel and to Judah in this book, but I believe especially the northern tribes of Israel, God gave them up. He turned them over to their enemies, and they essentially didn't ever reestablish as a nation again. Those remnant of them did join with Judah and did exist in the days of Jesus. And when John the Baptist and Jesus came preaching, that remnant did come to Christ and did return to him. So it talks about, of course, in verse 2, everyone knows, verse 2 is talking about the birth of Jesus, because it talks about, this is the verse that says he'll be born in Bethlehem. And then it says, therefore, he shall give them up until the time that she who is in labor has given birth. Now, I believe that means he'll give them up until the Messiah is born in Bethlehem. So it says, then the remnant of his brethren shall return to the children of Israel, that is, to the true Israel, which is in New Testament times the church. But you see, it talks about the birth of the Messiah, but it talks about God from Micah's time on giving them up until that birth, until the time that she who is in labor gives birth. Now, that she who is in labor gives birth evokes images from Revelation 12, where the woman is laboring to give birth to the male child, and he will rule the nations with a rod of iron. That's a reference to Christ. And the woman who gave birth to Christ was the remnant of Israel, or the nation of Israel. And therefore, she who labors giving birth is talking about the same thing as verse 2 is talking about, the birth of the Messiah in Bethlehem. And the giving up of Israel is until then, not after then.
Well, with the two kingdoms that were exiled, of course, Israel, the northern kingdom, was exiled, and for a time the southern one was as well.
Yeah.
Now, the northern one was never reestablished.
That's right.
So I guess I could see it fitting with this verse because insofar as the Gentiles were later brought into the kingdom, whomever would have been exiled from the northern kingdom had an opportunity to return there. But for the southern kingdom, well, they would have had that exile end at a subsequent point, but that would have been long before the woman who was in labor had borne a child, the time at which
you
that
mean,
comes.
You mean the return of the exiles from Babylon would be long before that?
Yeah, so that,
right.
That's, I guess, one thing I don't see lining up there, because if
but
they were
God,
exiled
but
for
God,
a time,
in a
well,
sense,
that, that time ended
God
up a lot earlier, right?
Here's the answer. God had, from the time of the Babylonian exile, given them up as a kingdom. I mean, they existed as a race of people. But remember, the prophecy about the Messiah born in Bethlehem is that he is going to be the ruler of Israel. That's what he says in verse 2. Out of Bethlehem shall come forth to me one who is to be ruler of Israel. What was given up when the Jews went in Babylon was the rulers, the line of the kings of Israel. And therefore, after they went into Babylon and came back, they never had a Jewish king again. And they were given up as a kingdom, so to speak. The kingdom was abolished, and it was reestablished when God sent the one born in Bethlehem who would be the ruler of Israel. And so that's what the giving of them up, I think, refers to. It doesn't mean that God would never have any contact with them at all, but that their nation would be ended, and they would have no ruler. They'd have no Jewish ruler. They'd have oppressive Gentile rulers, but they wouldn't have a ruler of Israel that was from God until he sent the Messiah. And that's what I would understand to be the meaning of those verses together.
Okay, that helps a lot. Now I understand. I have a second question if there's time. I don't know how many people you have in your queue today.
Actually, right now, you're the only one in there, so go ahead.
Oh, good. I might even get to ask two more.
You might. Hey, let me ask you a question. My wife grew up in Battleground, Indiana, and she wants to know, is Mama D's Pizza Place still in Dyer?
Oh, I couldn't tell you if it's there or not.
Oh, are you in Dyer?
I don't know of it. I live in Dyer, Indiana. That's right.
Yeah, well,
now,
she's familiar
Battleground
with that.
I haven't heard of, so that must be a bit of a ways away from where I happen to be located.
Okay. All right. Well, then I'll have to just tell her we don't know, and so we won't make any plans to
Mama
go there
D's
right away.
Mama D's is the name of it?
Yeah, that's what she says.
Well, I'll keep my eye out for it, and next time I call, I'll let you know.
In Dyer, she says, yeah. Okay, go ahead with your next question.
Well, the second question I had, actually, I've got two of them on the topic of eternal conscious torment.
Mm-hmm.
And one verse relating to it is, of course, Daniel 12:2 is used as a proof text against universal reconciliation.
Yeah, I think
now,
quite
I can
wrong
see how
here,
that would fit with eternal conscious torment and with annihilation, on the notion that the everlasting contempt or everlasting punishment is the punishment, not the punishing. But how it seems incompatible with the universal reconciliation view. I know that there's probably another way of understanding it, but maybe you could enlighten me about it.
Sure. The word everlasting in the Old Testament is the Hebrew word olam. And olam does not mean everlasting. It's an unfortunate thing that our English translations typically translate olam in the Old Testament as everlasting. And they also treat Aionios in the Greek New Testament as everlasting. And the two terms are essentially synonymous. The Septuagint, for example, used the Greek word Ionios to translate the Hebrew word Olam. And so when we find the word everlasting in the Old and the New Testament, we are finding an English translation that is questionable, to say the least. For example, all Hebrew scholars, and most, I think essentially all lexicons, would agree that the word Olam does not mean endless. It means beyond the vanishing point. It means over the horizon. What it means is beyond our point of view that we can see from here. So, in other words, it talks about something in the far distance, something that we can't see the end from here because it's over the horizon. But it doesn't necessarily mean forever. And therefore, the word Olam is used in the Old Testament to speak of anything that might last a long time. For example, in Psalm 24, it says, be lifted up, O you everlasting doors. And the, you know, the Olam doors, that's the doors of Jerusalem it's talking about as Olam. The everlasting hills are spoken of in the Old Testament. You know, they're not eternal, but they last longer than anyone knows, you know, how long it'll be. And so the word everlasting or eternal, as we think of that in English, is not necessarily the equivalent. But most scholars agree that both Olam in the Old Testament and Ionios in the New Testament can well be translated long-lasting or, you know, enduring a long time is essentially what the idea is. So when it says in Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. The everlasting contempt is the Olam contempt, long-lasting contempt. There'll be a long time that these people will be held in contempt. Now, there's nothing in this verse about their subjective experience of pain or suffering. It's talking about people who will be held in contempt. Now, we hold Adolf Hitler in contempt, but he's not aware of it. To remember somebody in infamy, that somebody, you know, their name goes down in infamy, doesn't mean that they are suffering for it after they've died. It just means that after they've died, they'll be remembered with contempt. There's nothing in this verse that suggests for a moment that the persons described are experiencing something, but it's talking about what people's memory of them will be. It'll be a contemptuous memory of them. They'll be held in contempt. So what's being said here is, and by the way, this is addressed to an honor-based society. We might feel like, well, what do I care what people think of me after I die? I'll be dead. Yeah, but an honor-based society, to be held in dishonor after you're died would be an awful thing. In fact, to tell you the truth, the Old Testament doesn't give much information about a life after this life, but to know that you died and that those who remember you will remember you with disgust rather than with respect would be more than most people would wish to bring upon themselves. And so to say that some will be awakening to everlasting life and some to everlasting shame and contempt would simply mean that some people's fate is to experience eternal life and some people's fate is to experience long-lasting contempt in the memory of them. But this doesn't even necessarily speak of the resurrection of the last day. I realize that most people would see it that way, but I believe that in the context of Daniel 12, we're talking about the destruction of the apostate Jerusalem in AD 70. And those who arise to eternal life are those who are experiencing a spiritual rebirth in Christ, and those who awaken to shame and contempt are really those who wake up to the fact that they're under God's judgment and that they remain the Jews who died and who were judged in 70 AD were held in the memories of others in great contempt. The reason I think that, there's actually more than one reason I think that. I generally derive my opinions about Daniel from the cross-references in the New Testament. And there are a number of cross-references in the New Testament to Daniel 12, all of which point to that particular time frame. But the one about awaking, Simeon, when he met Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus in the temple, he said this in Luke chapter 2 and verse 34. He said to Mary, he said, behold, this child is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel and for a sign which will be spoken against. And he says, for the fall and rising, the word rising there is anastasis, which means resurrection. But he's not talking about the resurrection of the last day. He's saying that many in Israel would fall and many would rise due to the influence of Christ. Those who would come to Christ would rise. Those who would reject him would essentially fall. And I think the reference to many in Israel is an allusion back to Daniel 12, because Daniel 12, 2 says, many who sleep in the dust shall arise, some to shame and contempt, some to everlasting life. But this can't be the resurrection of the last day, because that wouldn't be many, that'd be all. You see, Jesus said in John 5, 28 and 29, he says, marvel not at this, the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will come forth. And, you know, some to a resurrection of life, some to a resurrection of condemnation. But Jesus said in the resurrection, all who are in the graves will rise. Daniel doesn't speak about that. Daniel says, many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. The very statement, many of them, means not all of them. And therefore, he's not describing the universal resurrection, but he is using words very similar to what Simeon said. This child is set for the rising and the fall of many in Israel. And so I think that that's one of the several New Testament references that focus this passage, Daniel 12, not on the second coming of Christ or the end of the world, but on the first coming of Christ and the crisis that the Jews faced. This was, after all, the end of the 70 weeks that Daniel had talked about a few chapters earlier. And so I don't think Daniel looks beyond that.
Okay.
That's my thought.
That's very interesting. I hadn't heard that view before, and I assume the other New Testament texts would also support that idea.
In my opinion, they do.
In my opinion, earlier. They do.
I'm thinking primarily, you know, of 1 Peter chapter 1, where Peter says that the prophets wished to know more about their own prophecies and were told that it was not for them to know, but it was for a later generation to know. The only prophet Peter could be referring to is Daniel in Daniel chapter 12. Now, there's no prophet in the Old Testament who we find asking that question or receiving that answer except Daniel. So I think Peter's assuming that other prophets must have asked it too, but we know that Daniel did. And therefore, Peter is, in my opinion, referring to Daniel chapter 12, where Daniel asked that very question and received the exact answer that Peter mentions. And what does Peter say they were asking about? He said they were talking about the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow, which is our salvation. So, in other words, Daniel was talking about things that were going to be resultant from the sufferings and resurrection of Christ and the first generation of Christians, like Peter. Our salvation, he said. So, in my opinion, Peter and I think Simeon in Luke chapter 2, both are alluding to Daniel 12, and both of them applying it to the first coming of Christ, not the second.
Now, being that the word olam and anion don't refer necessarily to an everlasting time, upon what verses would you base confidence that life with Christ after the resurrection would also be everlasting opposed to just age abiding?
Well, the word aionios would not be where we would get that information. In other words, when the Bible talks about everlasting life, the word everlasting is also aionios in the Greek. And since the word aionios does not necessarily mean endless, we would not use those verses to prove that our salvation involves endless life. But we can use others. For example, John 5:24, where Jesus said, whosoever hears my words and believes in him that sent me has everlasting life, that is, life of the age. And he says, and shall not come into condemnation, but has passed from death into life. And in John 11, Jesus said, I am the resurrection of the life. He that believes in me, though he were dead, yet he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Now, terms like shall never die do not involve the word aionios. They give us information more than the word aionios does. Aionios would tell us that the life, aionios can mean long-lasting, as I pointed out, but it can also mean pertaining to an age or the age. And many scholars believe that the term aionios life means life pertaining to the age, to the next age. And it is not necessarily talking about the duration of it, so much as the nature of it. It's not life of this age. It's a life of the coming age. It would not necessarily tell us anything specifically about how long that lasts, except other verses do. Other verses tell mm-hmm. us that, you know, we'll never die. And that, yeah. See, the life that we receive is Christ's life, you know. And Jesus said, he that believes me shall never perish, you know. So there are these other places that add to our knowledge of our salvation, that this life of ours will never have an end.
That leads into my next question, because there's one Old Testament reference which I don't have a satisfactory answer for on eternal conscious torment that uses that kind of a shall never construct.
Okay.
And that would be Psalm 49, verse 19,
okay,
where it mentions, he shall go to the generation of his fathers. They will never see the light. Which, maybe I read too much into it.
Let's see, verse 19, yeah. They shall never see the light.
Yeah. Could you comment on that?
Well, for one thing, David is, in my opinion, speaking about physical death. And to say they will never see light, I believe he's simply saying, I don't think he's denying the resurrection. Let's put it that way. although I don't know if David knew about the resurrection. That's the point. David was not given any specific information about the resurrection. We read Job and his counselors talking about the state of the dead, blindly, because they don't know about the resurrection. And David sometimes didn't know about the resurrection, or didn't at least know the details, it would seem. And he often simply spoke of the fate of the lost. Actually, this isn't even David. This is Korah, a psalm of Korah. But the writer lived at a time where God had given no revelation about the afterlife. But later people, like, you know, later Jews, believed in a resurrection, and Jesus seemed to confirm that there would be a resurrection. This means that anyone who believed that people who die will never see light again, that wasn't quite right. They will. Jesus said everyone's going to see light again. Everyone's going to rise and stand before God and face judgment. So anyone who said they shall never see light is speaking from something other than divine revelation about the subject. Now, someone might say, but wait, this is in the Bible. Isn't everything in the Bible revealed by God? Not necessarily.
That's what I was just about to ask you.
Right, not necessarily. Not everything the counselors of Job said was revealed to them by God. In fact, the Bible specifically says that Job's counselors spoke wrongly about God, and yet their speeches make up the bulk of the book of Job. The book of Ecclesiastes, written by Solomon, contains a lot of sentiments that are not agreeable with the rest of Scripture. For example, in Ecclesiastes 9, it says the dead know nothing at all. They'll never, there's no more hope for them after they die. Well, that certainly is not taught in the New Testament. The New Testament teaches there is a hope beyond the grave. There is a resurrection. And so we have in the Old Testament sometimes, and I won't say it's not inspired, but it's not inspired in the sense that we may think that an inspired writing means that everything in it is reliable. But Genesis I take to be inspired, and yet we have the words of the devil quoted there, and they're not reliable. We have to take into consideration that God often inspired men to write their true grief, their true happiness, their emotions, and the Psalms and Job and Ecclesiastes are poetry books where that's what we find. They're what we call wisdom literature. And wisdom literature isn't necessarily the same thing as prophecy or as law. The Proverbs are a great example of how that the wisdom literature says things that may be sometimes true and sometimes not true. The Proverbs, you can't take the Proverbs to be universal promises of God. That's not what they are. When the Proverbs said that the diligent man will be wealthy and the slothful man will be in poverty, well, that might generally be true, but you'll find some slothful men who inherit wealth and they're plenty wealthy. And you'll find some men who work really hard and never get wealthy. So, in other words, when we look at wisdom literature, we have to realize that its inspiration is not the same as that of the prophets. Prophecy and wisdom literature are really different kinds of literature. And the wisdom literature, insofar as it's inspired, we'd have to say that God is inspiring these men to write their thoughts and their sentiments and their experiences and their emotions. And David sometimes, and other writers of the Psalms, say things that aren't very godlike at all. Like the psalmist in Psalm 137 who's wishing, you know, somebody to dash the baby's heads against the wall of the Babylonians, you know. That's not a very Christ-like sentiment. But it was the true sentiment. It was a perfect expression of the grief and anger that the Jews felt toward those who had done that very thing to them. So when we read the Old Testament, we need to be mindful of the fact that although God inspired it, he didn't inspire it all the same. For example, Moses' writings weren't inspired the same way the prophets were. Moses saw God face to face and wrote down what God told him. The prophets generally didn't. They got revelations and dreams and visions and so forth. And then Solomon, as far as we know, just wrote from the wisdom that God gave him. And the psalmist, David and Korah and the other psalmists, we're not told exactly how they prophesied, but, you know, it's a complex thing to figure out what the Old Testament is affirming and what it is simply just revealing about the nature of the anguish or the hopelessness that often was felt. You know, David in the Psalms, he sometimes says really negative things at the beginning of a psalm about how hopeless things are, and then at the end of the psalm he's changed his mind. And now he's rejoicing that there is hope and that God's going to come through after all. But it sounds in some of the earlier verses that, you know, God's abandoned them and he's far from them. So the Psalms present their own set of difficulties in knowing how to apply and interpret them. But in my understanding, if the sons of Korah wrote a psalm that said that the man who dies will never see light again, that is in direct contradiction to later revelation that was given through Christ, through the apostles, and very possibly even through some of the later prophets. So we find the psalmist expressing something that is perhaps true within the framework of what he's intending to say. I don't know if the psalmist is trying to deny that a resurrection will take place, although his words taken in an absolute sense would do so. He might not mean to be speculating about resurrection. He might mean to say that that guy's done. You know, that guy's had his day. His life is over. You know, he's not coming back. And from the framework of Earth's history, that's a true statement. And yet it's not a theologically absolute or all-inclusive statement, because it doesn't take into consideration that there is a resurrection, and the wicked as well as the righteous are going to be resurrected and stand judgment. So the psalmist didn't know that, but he may not have been intending to even address that subject. When he says they won't see light again, they'll never see light again, he may be speaking in terms of a limited range of consideration, like in this lifetime, they're gone.
Okay, thank you for that answer. Do you mind if I ask you one more question about the Gospels?
Peter, I'd be glad to answer another question about the Gospels. I have a lady who's been waiting for 10 minutes to talk to us, and I only have a few minutes left, 4 minutes left of the program. I think I should probably give her a chance.
I'll call another day.
Do. I'd be glad to talk to you further.
Thank you very much. Bye.
God bless you, Peter. All right, Carol from Las Vegas, welcome to The Narrow Path. You're going to get the last word, it looks like.
Okay, thank you very much. I just have a question about some of the things I've seen in the Bible. Now, I don't have the exact scripture, but at least two places that I know of, there was reference made to if you are saved, that your household will be saved also. And
yeah,
I just wonder, what is the household, and what does that entail? I mean, is it just your immediate family, or is that not true? Or I have questions about that.
Sure. You're referring to Acts 16:31, where Paul and Silas were in jail in Philippi, and an earthquake occurred, and the jail cell doors were opened, and the prisoners could escape but did not escape. And the jailer, upon learning that they had not escaped, realized that it was more or less a miracle of God that they hadn't left, and that Paul and Barnabas had an influence on probably keeping the prisoners there. And he somehow was just very impressed with them. He'd heard them singing praises to God all night long while their backs had been laid open with a whip and they were in chains. He wanted to get saved. And so he came running in and he said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" And they said, in Acts 16:31, Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you'll be saved, you and your household. Now, what that means is that this was going to be necessary for him as well as his household. They would have to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ also to be saved. In many cases, in some religions, the man of the house made the decisions for those, you know, the religious commitments of everybody in his house, and they didn't make their own decisions at all. He was like the owner, everyone in the house, his wife and children were like, you know, his property, and he made decisions for what the household would do. And I think Paul's saying, well, what applies to you also applies to your household. You have to believe in the Lord Jesus Christ to be saved, and your household's going to have to do that too, to be saved. In other words, you believing isn't going to get them saved. That's going to get you saved. Them believing will get them saved. And we then read further on in verse 34, now when they had he'd brought them into his house, he set food before them, and he rejoiced having believed in God with all his household. So all his household came to be believers also and were saved. Now some people take that verse to mean that if you get saved, everyone in your family is guaranteed to get saved. Well, that just doesn't happen. That's just not happening. And Jesus himself indicated that that would not happen. He said, if people follow him, they'll often find that those of their own household are their worst enemies. He said, I came to set a woman at variance with her daughter-in-law and a man at variance with his father and things like that, meaning that some people in the family would be followers of Christ and others would not. And there'd be strife between the family. There'd be a division in the family because some had become loyal to Christ and some had not. So Jesus made it clear that just because you're saved is no guarantee that your family's going to get saved. But what Paul meant is that you, sir, need to believe on the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and you'll be saved. And the same thing applies to your household, your family. They need to do that too.
All right. Well, you pretty much answered it. So thank you very much. And thanks a lot.
Okay, Carol. Good talking to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling us today. Bye now. All right, well, you've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast, and we're coming mighty close to the end of a calendar year, and of course, we do make decisions about which stations we will remain on and which stations we will not remain on, and the end of the year is a time where we make some of those decisions, and I'll just tell you how things stand. At this point, as always, we are without debt. We are paid up through December on all our stations. If we were not, we wouldn't be here because we will not go into debt. We pay in advance for the time. But at the same time, there have been stations that are not covering their own expenses. That is, people in certain areas are not covering all the expenses for us to be there. The reason we stay on is because people from other areas are paying enough, sending enough to help us pay for those areas. At this point, God has provided enough for us to stay this month and maybe next month on all the stations we're currently on. But month by month, we have to redecide. And sometimes at the beginning of the year, we make decisions. We actually, last January, we dropped a station very regrettably because of low responses. As the Lord provides, we will stay on the air. We will take no money for ourselves because there's no one salaried here, but we do have to pay for the time on the radio. We're listener supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air where you're listening to us, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Once again, that's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website. You can donate from our website, or you can just take resources that we have there for you for free, and don't bother to donate. That's fine too. It's all free, no strings attached. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. I'm Steve Gregg. Have a good weekend. Hope we'll talk again on Monday. God bless you. Thank you.